The matter of Christine Minsavage for David Minsavage versus the Board of Trustees of TPAF. May we please have appearances of counsel? Welcome, counsel. Mr. Kelly, please proceed.
May it please the court. This case is about a spouse's right to change her husband's retirement application to effectuate his intent to provide for his wife and his children following his impending death from pancreatic cancer. Rather than interpreting the statutes and regulations that govern the teacher's pension and annuity fund to compel its board of trustees to even consider whether David Minsavage's incapacity affords his wife, Christine, the right to change her husband's retirement application after he died, the lower court blindly followed the board's final administrative decision that stated, in short, that because her husband succumbed to cancer before he could appreciate an error in his benefit elections and change his retirement application to reflect his intentions, Christine could not do so on his behalf after his death. The reason stated for this decision was that upon his death, David was no longer a member of TPAF, and therefore, both he and his wife were stripped of his right to change the application. After more than a year of diligent effort by Christine to change her husband's application, arguing that her husband was incapacitated by his cancer when he made his retirement elections, the board issued the final decision, determining Christine was not entitled to any retirement benefits, but only a return of a contribution made by her late husband. The board never afforded Christine the opportunity for a hearing on the issue of David's incapacity, asserting that this matter does not entail any disputed questions of fact. Adopting the board's decision, the appellate division rejected Christine's claim that her husband's illness incapacitated him when he was completing his application, stating on page 9 of the decision that the record lacks support for this claim. I respectfully submit that the record contains ample support for the claim of incapacity that, but to the extent the record may be found as being thin, the reason for that is that the board did not want and did not allow the record to be fully developed. The board has repeatedly stated that it is without authority to grant Christine's request, regardless of her husband's lack of capacity, and continues to do so in its brief to this court. NJAC 17:3-6.3 provides that a member shall have the right to withdraw, cancel, or change an application for retirement at any time before the member's allowance becomes due and payable. The board maintains that because David died, he ceased to be a member of TPAF, and therefore 17:3-6.3 and all the rights David has under the code died with him. However, both petitioner's brief and respondent's brief cite case after case in which retiree survivors have been permitted to change a retirement option. The board argues that these cases are inapposite because, in these cases, the board has made a first decision on the application while the retiree was still alive and still a member of TPAF. But in Duven versus State, this court held the board of the public employee's retirement system had the power to allow a change to a retiree's application even when that person is no longer a member of the retirement system. The ruling recognized the inherent power of an administrative agency to, in the absence of legislative restriction, reopen, modify, or rehear orders previously entered by it. We ask this court to likewise recognize the inherent power of the TPAF board to reopen, modify, or rehear its order, specifically the final administrative decision denying Christine's appeal. This is a matter of public interest. Pensions are established and maintained to induce qualified persons to enter and continue in public employment, and this court has acknowledged that pension statutes should be liberally construed and administered in favor of the public employees they are intended to benefit. The board argues that it has no inherent power to reopen the application, and that the limit of its authority to administer the fund in favor of David and Christine is inferable from the enabling statute. Consequently, the board argues, its action in this matter is not subject to the Administrative Procedures Act. Yet again, the limitation of authority was not inferable to the many courts cited in both parties' briefs. The board's mechanical determination that it has no authority to change an application retroactively, coupled with a determination that reflects a decision in the nature of an interpretation of law or general policy, compel a ruling from this court that the board's actions denying the amendment of the application was agency rulemaking that is invalid for failure to comply with the APA. With that, I thank you for considering my prepared remarks.
Mr. Kelly, in the initial argument to the board, did the plaintiff argue that Mr. Minsavage had been incapacitated at the time he made the election?
They argued that he had been incapacitated and also received bad information in connection with his application.
In the initial argument to the board, that argument was presented?
I believe so, yes.
And at what point, can you tell us, was a hearing requested?
A hearing was requested after the final administrative decision was made.
Yes. Not before.
The bad advice was from the union, not from the board. Your client never went to the board. She went to the union representative. They were showed some forms of types of retirement, and it was determined that the most advisable one was the one where if he left after that period of time, and unfortunately no one could foresee that he would pass before that, but the bad advice was not from the board. The bad advice was from the union, the union representative.
That's
and
correct.
It really wasn't bad advice. But if there's an error in what occurred, it's not the board, it's the union representative that created the problem, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And we're not arguing that there's an estoppel argument here. We're arguing rather that the bad advice coupled with the illness deterred from Mr. Minsavage's capacity to make an informed decision.
So what is the principle? Obviously, any ruling that comes from this court on this case states a principle that consistent with the statutes that would govern not only your case but others. What is the principle that you would articulate that a retiree survivor can change an election after the death of the retiree or after the death of the member of the because he's not wasn't a retiree after the death of a member of the system when under what circumstances?
So the board says that it infers that it has no authority or ability.
Not my question, okay? I'm asking you, I understand that the board said it had no authority, but if you are asking us to rule in favor of your client, what is the principle under which we should state, which would include presumably some cases but exclude others? What's the limiting principle?
Well, the principle would be that a member has the ability to retroactively revise an application despite the fact that he has passed away.
Well,
if that were the case, why would anyone choose an option that would give less than the maximum benefits?
Well,
there is a bit of a trade-off. Set aside this case. There is a bit of a trade-off based on the decision that the applicant reaches. Why would anyone ever opt for something that would give them less?
Well, the statutes involved talk about when the effective date of the retirement benefits kick in. When you're electing your benefits, you make that election within a year of when those benefits come into place. In this situation, we have a situation where Mr. Minsavage had made the election, had clearly expressed an intent to do otherwise, and that intent is no longer being effectuated. It comes down to the intent, Your Honor.
What is the to do otherwise that he chose? As I understand, what is the to do otherwise that you're speaking of? My understanding is that we have to discuss it with the union representative. He and his wife determined that was the way that we maximize the retirement benefits was by retiring early in that year. So what is the other? I don't understand
well,
the
so
other.
So there's a difference
about.
Between maximizing retirement. Well, there are different ways to maximize your retirement benefits. And what he was seeking to do was to maximize the retirement benefits that he and his children were to receive upon his passing. He was aware of his impending death, and so he was trying to arrange it so that Christine and the children would get the benefits that he would.
I understand that. That's what he chose, but you mentioned he chose to do that or otherwise. I don't know what the other choice was that he faced or that he provided. That was the only thing
so
he chose.
What he checked was early retirement.
Right.
And he didn't make it quite to the 25 years.
I understand
but
that.
He checked the early retirement error, thinking that the early retirement was going to give Christine and his children the maximum benefit after he passed away.
Had he now unfortunately passed away before the year, he would have derived the benefit of that pension plan that maximized the benefits. The problem was, unfortunately, he didn't make it to the retirement date.
2 months.
Well, again, it's back.
2 months.
I get back, Your Honor, to his intent. His intent was clearly to elect to provide his spouse and his children with the benefits for her lifetime. The problem that he experienced was that he was never afforded during this whole process, or Christine was never afforded during this whole process, the ability to actually demonstrate that intent, put in the evidence that would demonstrate that intent.
So, I'm trying to understand your argument. So he obviously never expressed this intent. So I'm assuming your argument is the intent is implied. I mean, he applied for early retirement pension, but at some point it became clear that he was not going to make it to the 25 years and that he was incapacitated from converting that to an accidental disability pension. And your argument, I take it, is that our pension laws are to be liberally construed. There are a number of cases in which our courts, including our Supreme Court and our appellate division, have permitted these conversions even after the member has died, and you're asking us to follow in that course.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that your argument?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Yeah, exactly. The Steinman Court, for example, the case, we would ask that we...
But also Harris and Bumbaco.
Isn't Harris even a more extreme situation than we have here? There we have a surviving spouse asking to be able to demonstrate to the board on a remand through a hearing incapacity in order to change an option selection that would have directly increased the surviving spouse's amount that they could take when before there had been no surviving spouse. Here we already have an application that had been put in by the purported retiree-to-be indicating a desire to benefit his surviving spouse, and he was never given the opportunity to, or he lost the opportunity to make the change that she's now trying to make on his behalf.
Correct.
In any of the cases before where the boards, various boards, not just TPAF, have allowed surviving spouses to make changes in a member's selection, has this membership prohibition ever come up before?
It has, Your Honor. And the case was, I believe, Duven. Where the concept is this.
Let me state the question differently, because I think you might be misapprehending what I'm asking you. I could not come up with another case where the pension board, a pension board, has argued this membership requirement have to be present in order to make a change in a selection after somebody has passed.
Can you clarify the heart of your argument? Is it that when he made the decision, he was incapacitated, and that therefore there should be a review again, either a review of his incapacity through a remand, or if your argument were to prevail, that there's enough in the record for us to find right now that the alternate remedy could be provided? Or is your view that when someone had an intent that can to provide for one's family, that after the fact you just change the designation?
No, not just changing the designation. The intent plus the incapacity. There has to be good cause shown. There has to be reasonable grounds. And so it's not just that someone changed their mind. It's that someone had an intent and did not fill out the application in a manner consistent with that intent.
Because?
And then because he lacked capacity to do so.
So that would be a limiting principle, going back to my other question. In other words, if someone had, for example, been in very good health up through the time that the decision was being made, and then there's no suggestion of incapacity, and then passed away, and then the spouse wanted to change change the selection at that time, you wouldn't be arguing that that's in the same category as your case.
Correct. Thank you for clarifying that question, Your Honor. That's absolutely.
Is there any place that defines? I understand how the board is asking member to be defined. Other than the part that says once you become a teacher, you're a member. Is there anything else? Any statute, any regulation that defines what a member of this pension program is?
I'm unaware of it, Your Honor. I do know that there's case laws out there that says even when someone was no longer a member, they were allowed to revise their application.
Right.
They had been out of membership for a significant period of time, but they were still allowed to revise their application.
So we've had members making alterations after an application has been put in, whether or not it's been approved, and we've had surviving beneficiaries make application and upon demonstrations of incapacity in the decision-making process, for example, they've been able to secure a change through the board's action based on that reasoning.
That's correct, and the board here is arguing that it just has no power or no authority to do so, and we are arguing that it has the authority, and case law is clear on that.
Is there anything, any of the cases, any of the regs, the statutes, that talk about approval of a retirement application as a prerequisite to amending a retirement application? Is there anything that says that it has to be first approved?
No, the regs and the statute are about the effective date of the retirement benefits. It doesn't go to the board's argument.
And although the cases, and you've cited a bunch of them, were cases where, in fact, the application was submitted and approved before they sought amendment, is there anything in those cases that say the application has to be approved before it can be amended, or said if it hadn't been approved, we wouldn't allow the amendment? Anything to that effect that you're aware of?
Can I ask a question to clarify the record? Mr. Minsavage, when he was alive, planned to retire at the end of the school year, June 30, I believe, and he would have secured 25 years of service. As I understand the record, he was no longer actively teaching sometime in December at least. Was he on leave of absence during that time period? Because the employer board submitted a certification that I was referenced in this record that his last day of service would be June 30, and then later on submitted a certification that his last day of service without any change was the day before he died as opposed to the day on which he did in fact pass away. Am I understanding this record correctly?
So, Mr. Minsavage, although he was very ill, began the school year in September in an effort to actually build up vacation days that he thought were going to be counted towards his creditable service. That didn't turn out to be the case. However, he worked from September through December. At which point he was no longer able to work, and he stopped working in December.
What was
he was without pay? He was considered in active service by his employer, as far as I can tell on this record, until the anticipated June 30th date. And then the employer changed that and certified to the pension board that his last day of active service was the day before in which he passed away. And I'm trying to understand how the board did that, because that had the effect of denying this gentleman and his family death benefits, because he didn't die in service.
Well, I agree with you that it had the effect to deny the family the benefits. Unfortunately, Your Honor, I don't know factually whether he was actually receiving pay while he was at home. I know that he ended he stopped working, he stopped going to the school in December of that year.
But the board, the employer, was certifying him as being in active service and then unilaterally alter that. This is something that I suppose a remand hearing might be able to explore, correct?
Correct.
I assumed
Thank
he
you.
Was being paid. I assume that the school board, to the greatest extent possible, was trying to assist him to get to his early retirement date of June 30th. It just didn't work out.
That's correct.
I mean, the school board on its own, under our statutes, given his condition, very grave condition, could have on its own moved for an accidental disability pension. They had the power to do that, right?
For ordinary disability.
Ordinary disability. They could have, the school board, without the consent, given his condition, could have moved for an accidental disability pension.
Ordinary.
I'm sorry. I said ordinary.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
So you're arguing that...
Am I right about that?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
You're arguing that it is a discretionary decision on the part of the board, and all you want is a hearing to demonstrate why they should exercise their discretion and allow him to amend.
Yes, we'd like the hearing to actually provide the evidence that...
He was incapacitated.
Exactly.
And what he really was trying to do with his pension.
Exactly.
Under NJSA 18A66-38, which talks about the death benefits issue that I'm concerned about here, allows for proofs of somebody being in service, and it specifically allows for somebody to continue in service on official leave without pay due to personal illness and still be considered in service, so long as that period is not in excess of 2 years. So Mr. Minsavage would have qualified under this statute, it appears, whether he was being paid or not.
And again, Your Honor, if he had had the capacity to realize that prior to his death, he would have made that election.
And all these are all things that you would explore on remand.
Counsel. And this may be a question I better ask of Ms. Chung, but if the facts were changed a little bit, if Mr. Minsavage had passed after receiving his pension as worked out with the NJA advice, and then his widow chose to change it because he was receiving, she would be entitled to make an application, would she not, to change the pension for some whatever reason?
I believe so, Your Honor.
So the issue here is that he passed before he began receiving the benefits.
Well, the issue here is that, one, his intent was not satisfied, and two, he was incapacitated in order to revise that application to be consistent with his intent.
So what is the date of the conversion? When are you saying that as of this date he would have applied for an ordinary disability pension? Are you following me? Because you're right now you're seeking ordinary disability pension, correct?
So, I believe. Well, here's the issue. It's impossible to answer that question, Your Honor, in that David was incapacitated.
So this is the practical reason I'm asking your question. I'm assuming he was paid through April. I don't know if he was or he wasn't. Your client behind you is sort of indicating yes, but if that would make it. If you are on an ordinary disability pension, you wouldn't be making your salary. You'd be making something less, correct? So someone would have to be deciding, if this conversion were permissible, what was the date that it would begin And then that would have to be like offset against the salary that he might have received during that same period, at least part of it. Are you following what I'm saying?
Yes, I'm following what you're saying. And again, I guess it would be something that would have to be explored upon remand. The
right.
date would have happened sometime between essentially
December.
November and December.
Is there a difference in benefits between the amount one would receive under early retirement and the amount under an ordinary disability?
I'm not sure of the exact number, Your Honor, but yes, there's a difference, and there's quite a difference in the amount that Christine has received in terms of just a return of the contributions.
Place that to one side. And the difference is?
I'm not certain of the actual number difference, Your Honor, between the...
Under which does one receive a greater amount of benefits?
Christine and her children will receive a greater amount of benefits under the ordinary disability.
Greater than under the early retirement?
Well, in this situation...
I'm not asking about the facts of this case. I'm asking you to compare the level of benefits that one would receive under those two schemes.
I don't know the difference between the
Which one is better? Which one yields greater benefits, greater payments?
I don't know the answer to that.
I would suspect it's early retirement is better.
I would
better
assume just
because of the
on
additional service time and the way in which the formulas work.
So the reason I ask the question is, what date should we look at for assessing incapacity? Shouldn't it be the date on which the application is submitted?
Well, yes, because he was that is a good date to choose because he was incapacitated at the time the application was put in. And so if we're trying to revise that application, that would be the natural date that you would go back to.
Because if you were to look at a later date, most individuals who are suffering could claim that there was a period of time shortly before their passing that they were incapacitated, which would open up every one of these cases. No?
Right. Yeah, so the natural date would be that of the application.
That might be the natural date, but it may be ignoring the reality. In November, his dire condition may not have been fully understood. There may have been a reasonable expectation he could have made it till July or June 30th. At some point along the way, his condition deteriorated greatly, maybe after January, February, or March. And it's at that point where he may not have had the capacity to convert it. He was just under so much drugs and so much... Exactly. So I going back to November may just be a fiction, no?
I agree that it's hard to choose a date, Your Honor, but I would say that if you have to pick a date, we are arguing that David was incapacitated even at the time of his initial application.
Yeah, we are making that argument. That distinguishes your case, again, from a number of other cases, because if you picked as the date the day before a person's death, obviously people's health conditions vary, but generally the date before their death, they're likely to be found incapacitated, and that would loop in really almost anyone who passed away prior to reaching that key date.
Yes.
But in your case, you're saying that from diagnosis until this gentleman's death, it was extremely rapid. He was ill at the time of, very ill at the time of his diagnosis, and also, you know, obviously went downhill further prior to his death.
And there is case law out there that says not only can you, and this is maybe why I've been struggling, I have this concept in my mind, not only is it the day that you filled out your application, which we are arguing he was incapacitated on, but it's also during any of the time that he could have revised his application himself in order to make it consistent with his intent. So, yes, the natural day to select for revising the application would be the day that he put in the initial application because is our argument and position that he was incapacitated at that time and therefore did not make the election that went along with his intent.
Is it your contention that Mr. Minsavage was, by virtue of what you say was his incapacity, did not understand the consequences that would occur if he didn't make that 25-year date. In other words, if he passed away before that date.
Well, I think that is true, Your Honor. I also think that it could go to the fact that he did not understand the application process. Your Honor correctly points out that the NJEA gave him information and it was bad information, and we're not holding that against the board. But had he had more capacity, he may have been able to recognize himself or figure out himself that perhaps the elections that are being suggested to him in highlight would not effectuate his intent.
But that's all got to be, you're saying that's got to be determined on a remand for a hearing or for an ALJ to decide if he's got good cause, if he was in fact incapacitated, when in fact what's the right date, presumably the date of the application. That's all got to be determined at some point, you want, based upon the facts adduced at the hearing.
Well, we would like this court to, based on the record before it, including David's medical records, David's service and his inability to serve beyond December, the certification, sworn certification of his wife, detailing his illness, the letter from his oncologist.
Does that tell us the date of his incapacity?
No, we would have to go back again to the original date of the application.
And you're not contending that
in other words, the doctor doesn't say as of this date he was incapacitated. The medical records don't say as of this date he was incapacitated.
When does the doctor write the letter?
It all goes to the pain.
When did the doctor write the letter?
I don't recall the date of the letter.
May 31st, 2016.
I'm sorry?
May 31st. Is this Dr. Sherba's letter?
That was after he passed.
It was after.
And it's a relatively short letter.
Yes.
It says, can impact decision-making.
Yes.
If one were to attempt to make a determination of incapacity, wouldn't it benefit from a hearing to allow evidence to be presented?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. And that's where testimony from the Board of Education would be helpful. Obviously, their understanding of his ability to do the job since... Ordinary disability is a remedy for an employee as well as for an employer. It goes both ways, and they obviously were aware of this gentleman's condition.
His colleagues, his treating physicians,
right.
His family,
the NJEA.
Yeah, and the pension board has not had an opportunity to have their doctors review the medical records and take a position on the record yet either.
Anything you'd like to add?
That's it. Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Chung.
May it please the Court. The pension statutes contemplate three general categories of people: active members, retired members, and beneficiaries who have distinct rights and benefits. When an active member of TPAP dies, his beneficiary, who can be anyone, is paid death benefits, which consist of group life insurance amounting to 3.5 times the member's final salary, plus the member's contributions to TPAP with interest. When a retired member of TPAP dies, his beneficiary is paid significantly reduced group life insurance and may receive a pension depending on the payment option chosen by the member. The legislature recognized that active members may apply for their retirement and die while their retirement applications are pending. The general rule is that these applicants are treated as active members. A statutory exception allows beneficiaries to request that the retirement chosen by the member become effective. As a matter of statutory interpretation, this exception to the general rule should be narrowly construed. In this case, Mr. Minsavage was an active member of TPAP when he died, Therefore, his beneficiary, Mrs. Minsavage, is entitled to the death benefits for an active member. Because Mr. Minsavage did not have 25 years of service credit, he did not qualify for an early retirement, and he cannot be treated as a retired member. Mrs. Minsavage now wants to change Mr. Minsavage's application to one for an ordinary disability retirement, but beneficiaries cannot change ineffective retirement applications. Moreover, changing the application would be ineffective as well, due to the fact that Mr. Minsavage was still teaching at the time of his application, and thus not permanently and totally disabled or incapacitated. Mr. Minsavage's choice to apply for an early retirement was not based on bad information from his union. As the appellate division noted below, early retirement represented the most sensible option because it provided greater benefits both before and after Mr. Minsavage's scheduled retirement. In conclusion, hindsight will always be 20/20, but the pension funds cannot be administered on this basis. Allowing beneficiaries to change ineffective retirement applications after the member's death, or even to file what are essentially post-death retirement applications, would be unworkable. It also would jeopardize the fiscal integrity of the pension funds, which this court has long understood is of paramount concern. Accordingly, the decision below should be affirmed. Thank you.
You've heard the argument that Mr. Minsavage was incapacitated at the time that he submitted the application, at the time he made his selection. Assume that's correct. What remedy does a person in that status have?
Assuming that Mr. Minsavage was both incapacitated and also teaching?
I don't want to argue the merits of it. I would like to know what remedies an individual who is incapacitated at the time of the selection has.
Given that the member is incapacitated, if there were somebody who had power of attorney over that person and could act on behalf of the member, that person might be able to apply for a retirement, an ordinary disability retirement.
Up until what point? Or at any point?
The member would still have to be alive. The Ordinary Disability Retirement Statute does contemplate applications by either the member or the member's employer or somebody else, but the member must be alive. Once the member passes, he passes as an active member, and his beneficiaries would not, their right, any right that the beneficiary had would not ripen.
So assume a situation where an individual passes 1 week after making the selection. And there's absolutely no dispute that at the time of the selection, the person was incapacitated. Once those 7 days have run, there's no remedy?
Again, the statute is very clear that the member needs to be alive. So
where
once
does
the
it
member,
say that?
If you look at NJSA 18A:66-4. 39. This is both the ordinary and accidental disability retirement statute. But in subsection, you can put A or B.
Can you cite the full statute? I couldn't hear you. I'm sorry.
It's 18A:66-39. That's the disability.
40?
39. That's a disability retirement statute.
Tell us what you're relying on, please. What part of the statute?
This is the second sentence of both A, B. The physician or physicians designated by the board shall have first made a medical examination of him at his residence or any other place mutually agreed upon. So the legislature is contemplating that that the member is still alive and may be examined.
Is this coming back to the contention that there must have been an approved application before you can have a change? In other words, I'm trying to figure out how what you just cited relates to a circumstance, the circumstance we're talking about here. He's not an active member. He's not a retired member. but he's an active member at the time of his death, and that cuts him out. How does that say that? How does what you just read say that?
That's a different statute.
So okay, but I'm trying to get at, is what you're saying related to the contention that the board has had and the court had, the appellate division had, that you have to be approved before you can amend it?
I'd like to distinguish between what a member can do and what the beneficiary of a member can do. So the member can always change his or her application until the point the retirement becomes due and payable 30 days after either the board approves the retirement or the effective
date. But some of these members may be deceased within 30 days. They're no longer active members. They died. Okay, go ahead. Finish. I'm sorry. Continue.
So the member can always change. Now, once the member dies, if in your scenario the board has not approved the application yet, the beneficiary can choose, and this is a different statute that I can cite you to, but the beneficiary can ask the board to make the retirement effective. So, yes, the member has died. The retirement was not approved before the member died, but the beneficiary can still request that the retirement become effective. But until a retirement becomes effective, the beneficiary has no rights. And that's something I'd like to just address, Justice LaVecchia. The cases where beneficiaries were able to change payment options are qualitatively different from this case.
Can I ask you to come to that in a second? I still would like you to give us the statutory authority for the proposition, because Section 39, as I'm looking at it, appears to apply when someone affirmatively applies for a disability retirement. And it's sensible. If they want the benefits of a disability retirement, the other side should have the opportunity to conduct a medical examination and make that determination. This is different. The situation we're talking about is where someone lacks the capacity at the time they submit an application. Is there another statute that you rely on to say that cannot be reconsidered at a later point because of the lack of capacity?
Again, if the member lacks capacity, the member cannot change it. If there were somebody who had a power of attorney for the member, then that person could change it. What we have here is a beneficiary trying to change the retirement type after the member's death. So I understand Your Honor's question, but it's a different fact situation here where the member applied for retirement, and there were no changes made during the member's lifetime.
Stay away from the facts for just a moment. If I understand you correctly, you're saying there is no remedy. Short of the individual with power of attorney stepping in.
Yes.
And you rely on that? You rely on what for that proposition? Aside from Section 39.
Reading Section 39 in conjunction with Section 47, 66-47, which concerns the different retirement options that a member can choose, the legislature is very clear that the beneficiary, here anyway, would have certain rights but could not, for example, change the retirement application that the member had made.
So you're saying under the law and under the case law, you cannot amend an application. Essentially, you cannot amend an application after the member's death. Can you ever amend an application after the member's death?
The only way you could amend it is for the payment option. So once the board has approved a retirement, that member becomes...
Now we get back to the board has to have approved it in order for you to amend it. Because you're changing a payment option, you're not changing the nature of the benefit.
Someone other than the member cannot change the approved allow the approved retirement unless you're seeking a change to the payment option.
Okay.
Yes.
Where does it say that?
If you...
Those are the two statutes you cited for us.
If you read Section 47, which again is the provision for beneficiaries to request that non-approved retirements become effective, if you read that in conjunction with the rule, which is NJAC 17:3-6.3A, this regulation allows the member to change the application up through the time it becomes due and payable.
And you're saying that's the authority by which the board denied the application here, the application to amend?
Yes. Mrs. Misavage was not the member. She is the beneficiary of a retirement application that did not become effective.
Do you know whether or not the Misavage family received the death benefits that you referred to at the beginning of your argument?
To my knowledge, the group life insurance of 3.5 times Mr. Misavage's final salary, that has been paid. The contributions, I believe there's paperwork that still needs to be finalized for that to be paid, but that would be the full amount of an active member's death benefits.
You're saying Mr. Misavage, however, before his death, could have come in and amended his application?
Yes, Mr. Misavage, as the member, had the right to change his application.
And if he is incapacitated, he's dying of cancer, he's deceased relatively soon, and is incapacitated, somebody would have had to come in on his behalf, presumably a power of attorney.
Yes, Your Honor.
Unless, of course, he didn't have the capacity to sign a power of attorney.
I would hope, Your Honor, if somebody's at that stage, that there would have been measures taken to have somebody able to, I mean, there are lots of things that happen towards the end of someone's life, and if the person's incapacitated, then you can get guardianship. There are measures that can be taken to deal with that.
And he could have done so even though it hadn't been approved.
Yes, Mr. Misavage could have changed his own application.
Even if it had not been approved yet.
Yes.
Now, you mentioned that you view this case as distinguishable from other cases in which a surviving spouse has been permitted to amend an application.
Yes.
Why is that?
The amendment is solely to the payment option. So once the retirement system approves a retirement, there's a certain sum of money that's set aside. And as to how that money gets paid out, there are beneficiaries who would like a bigger portion or to be paid something rather than nothing. And so all of the cases that involve beneficiaries are payment option cases where you have to have an approved retirement with a pension that's being paid to the member, and then the beneficiary's rights at that point ripen, and they can come in and request that the change happen.
But and that's a statutory, I'm sorry.
This is along the lines of what Justice Patterson was talking about. The Harris case, you're familiar with it?
Yes.
Was it correctly decided?
Harris involves tolling when somebody becomes incapacitated during the 30 days when the member would have been able to change an approved retirement. So again, it's a different situation from here where there was no approved retirement.
And that's already
after approval?
Why
is that legally
approval?
Significant? Sorry.
The person died. The person was no longer a member. Death had intervened. And the family member, the decedent, was able to change the pension option. The original pension option was everything was going to go to the member. And then the decedent, after the death of the spouse, was able to change it so that he became a beneficiary, no?
There was an approved retirement in Harris and in every other retirement option case.
So is it that the amount of the retirement didn't change? What changed was the amount paid to different members, but the actual amount of the retirement benefit did not change? Is that the difference?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't know about the exact, you know, dollars and cents here, but there's an actuarial determination as to how much is going to be paid out, and the beneficiary is saying that they should get either something or more than what the member had provided
well,
for.
Well, in Harris, without the change, the spouse was going to get nothing, no?
There was still an approved retirement.
But the approved retirement was for all of the pension benefits to go directly to the member, because the member had not checked off the lower benefits so that the spouse would become a beneficiary upon her death. Upon her death, the spouse was permitted to retroactively change that application so that he became a beneficiary, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, but it still goes to the payment option and not the type of retirement.
Well, is that really the distinction? Is that a distinction without a difference? Is that a true distinction from
no,
this
Your
case?
No, Your Honor. You need to have an approved retirement for the beneficiary to have
any
right. It's an inchoate, undeveloped right so long as the retirement hasn't been approved. Once the retirement is approved, I understand that in Harris, there's a beneficiary who's coming forward who would not have gotten anything. But at the very least, there's an approved retirement in that case, and there is none here.
But that's in the statute. You're saying that the rights given to the beneficiary were grounded in the statute in Harris, and would not, and the rights of the beneficiary in this case are not grounded in the statute. I mean, is it that distinct, or is it interpretive that's going on here?
So Harris is an amalgamation, I guess. You have Section 47, which says that the beneficiary can request that the retirement chosen by the member become effective. In Harris, that retirement became effective. Then you have the beneficiary saying, given this approved retirement, I would like the payment option to be changed because the member was incapacitated at the time she chose to not pay him. So, if I got those right. So it again goes back to whether there is an approved retirement or not.
Can I ask you a question about ordinary disability? Because Section 47 is talking about retirement allowance, which typically I was understanding to be the service retirement allowance. Are there options available for selection by the retiring member under ordinary disability?
In terms of payment options,
yes.
Okay. The various options are how much you get paid versus how much your beneficiary gets paid. So there are payment options for disability retirement.
For disability as well.
But you're saying that
no.
You said for disability. You're saying there's a distinction. I probably won't be able to articulate this correctly, but you're saying there's a distinction under the law between a jump from one form of payment option to another for an approved retirement in the same category of retirement. And in that case, the spouse in Harris and in the other cases that have been cited is allowed to make that retroactive switch within that the world, the sphere in which the switch is made is between payment options for an approved retirement versus you are saying, and I just want to make sure I understand, that the two different categories of benefits, the spouse cannot after the fact, jump from one to the other.
Yes, because if there's a retirement that has not been approved or made effective, the spouse has no rights. Whereas if there is a retirement that has been approved, then the spouse would have beneficiary rights and could request a change in the payment option.
But Harris... The Harris decision was based upon an equitable principle of tolling. So I'm just going to read this like one sentence. I want to see whether or not it has any application to this case. If you read along, it's on page 465. We found that the decedent's physical incapacity during the required 31-day option period deprived him of the full benefit of that time, and held that his wife was entitled to a tolling of the time limitation to permit her to convert the insurance. We are satisfied that the facts here require a similar result. So I just want us to consider for a moment this concept of equitable tolling. Why wouldn't this concept of equitable tolling not apply to the point where Mr. Minsavage became incapacitated. We'll just assume for the sake of argument, at some point before his death, he became incapacitated and therefore unable to convert his early retirement to ordinary disability. So assume that there is this equitable principle. As of that moment, it was told, so we don't get to the point of his death, and then retroactively permit his wife or his family to apply for this conversion. Like, why wouldn't that be similar to what occurred in Harris? Since equitable tolling is a judicial principle, correct? Wasn't created by the statute. The court created that in Harris in order to achieve an equitable, fair, just result, correct? Right?
Courts have applied equity to help members, beneficiaries, get the result that they want. In terms of applying the equities just straight up, Zygmunt, the case that this court decided back in 1983, I think, cautioned that courts should not be applying equity in pension cases, that these decisions should really be made by the boards exercising their discretion. So to the extent that you're asking if the board would accept equitable tolling in this kind of fact scenario, the board would not. Again, the board needs to be free to exercise its discretion to reach decisions in individual cases that will have repercussions for the entire pension fund.
Can you amplify that? Tell us about the fiscal integrity argument that you raised earlier.
Actuarial assumptions are what drive how much money is in the fund, how much money the legislature needs to appropriate, how much it drives a lot. And so to the extent that you have ineffective retirement applications, which mean there's no retirement granted, this is back in 2014, 2015, and so the actuaries have factored that into their calculus as to what reserves need to be taken going forward. It goes to the experience of the fund. If we now have a situation, and again, this case is unprecedented in terms of a beneficiary of an ineffective retirement application requesting a change to make that retirement effective, that changes the landscape. The actuaries now need to factor in whether people who would not have been allowed to change retirement applications.
That was true in Harris. I mean, look, I'm not saying that was true in Harris too, was it not? Because Harris said the decedent had 30 days to change her option. She didn't. She died. After the fact, the decedent made an application to change the nature of her retirement application, and the court decided we're going to toll that 30-day period at the point that she became incapacitated and allowed her husband to retroactively change the retirement so he could benefit. That's what occurred in Harris, correct?
Yes.
Could you finish your answer to the Chief's question about what your argument is with respect to the integrity of the funds?
Sure. I'll try to do both and remember your question, Your Honor.
I'm sorry, you can...
But in terms of just the hard facts here, TPAF is underfunded by 40% or so, and so you have liabilities that greatly outweigh assets, and the pension fund is trying to safeguard those assets to pay pensions going forward. If beneficiaries are allowed to request changes after the fact, after a member's death, it does open the floodgates to many other applications being made for retirements after the fact, or in cases where there is a retirement but somebody wants a better retirement, the most advantageous retirement. This could have escalating consequences for the pension funds. And so that is definitely something that TPAF and the other boards are well aware of.
But that's true in every case that requires some showing of just cause to amend. That same argument in every case. We're opening the floodgates, whereas it goes on a case-by-case basis, and the unique facts of every one of those cases will determine whether, in fact, there's been an amendment or not. And, in fact, there has been no opening of any floodgates, even though we already have that rule, that it can be amended upon a showing of just cause. I mean, isn't that true?
It's both good cause and reasonable diligence. And in case
Reasonable diligence. If that's the standard, that's the standard. If it doesn't change and this is not a new standard, how is that going to open the floodgates when they haven't been opened up till now?
Again, the cases to this point have been qualitatively different in that there was an approved retirement.
None of those cases say that approval was required, do they?
If you read...
I've actually read it. Now, I get you. I get your point.
So part of your argument, I asked you about Harris. The same argument that you've just advanced would apply to Harris, correct? That's a floodgates argument. The court applied equitable tolling to allow the decedent to retroactively change the retirement policy so that the beneficiaries, the family, would be able to benefit.
Again, Harris had an approved retirement. There was going to be a financial consequence for the fund. The fact that the wife died early or before the retirement became effective meant that that money would not go to the wife, and so the husband was allowed to request that the pension be paid to him. Again, to the extent that Harris is an equitable tolling case, it really should be read in light of what this court said in Zygmunt.
How much of a floodgates argument would there be if there were a requirement of proof of incapacity at the time of the election, of the decedent's incapacity at the time of the election, not at some later date between that date and the decedent's death? Do you understand what I'm saying? Is this a meaningful limiting principle that would undercut a floodgates argument?
Potentially. The fact that the member is actually making an election goes to the member's capacity. At the very least, the person in today's operational status, you have to go online to open up your MBOS account to make the election. And so
the question wasn't clear because I'm not getting into whether he was incapacitated or not. So not going into that at all. My question is, if in fact you've talked about after the fact or decisions or revisions of decisions by spouses, surviving spouses opening the floodgates to assumptions that were inconsistent with the actuarial assumptions that are the core of managing the funds. Would that floodgates argument be mitigated if the surviving spouse had to prove incapacity as of the decedent as of the date of the election?
To the extent that there is a limiting factor, yes, it would reduce the size, I guess, of the floodgates. But again, to ask the pension funds to consider requests based on retroactive back-in-time determinations of whether the member had capacity or not, it does change things operationally. You would have to have doctors who would certify that the member was incapacitated as of a particular date. And that's very difficult to do after the fact. In this particular case,
I understand that goes to the proofs. I'm not commenting on whether this could be proven or not, but I'm suggesting something well short of a surviving spouse can look at how life has turned out and make an after the fact determination, as opposed to a very specific type of proof that surviving spouse would have to put in.
Again, to the extent that there's a limiting factor, yes, that would reduce the chances of the floodgates being opened.
And don't we have to realize that pension funds are not an entitlement, that they're earned? that the teachers put in, what, 7.5% of their salaries in order to pay into these pensions. And so when we're balancing the equities here, don't we take that into account? That the fact that there's a pension system for them is a result of trying to get good qualified teachers into the system and make sure that they're covered when they leave.
Yes, Your Honor, that's the purpose of a pension. I will say Mr. Misavage earned the right to apply for the retirement that he chose. So it's not as if he was punished in any way here or that he didn't get what he had earned. He had the right to apply for a retirement. In this particular case, he chose an early retirement, which would have been very beneficial had he lived till July. And the unfortunate thing here is that he didn't. But he still had the right to apply, and that is what he earned.
Ms. Chung, we understand that your position is no hearing should take place. There should not be a remand here. Can you nonetheless tell us, based on your understanding of the record, when was the argument about incapacity first raised, and when was a request for a hearing first made?
As to incapacity, I don't have a specific chronology, but the very first letter from Mrs. Misavage to the Division of Pensions and Benefits, which is from June 18, 2015, and that's in the appendix at page 89, refers to not knowing how sick Mr. Misavage was. That, in my reading, does not go to incapacity. It goes to how quickly his condition deteriorated. And then after that,
and the legal arguments to the board?
I think the legal arguments were made. In a letter from counsel to the board.
I know it's in the appeal of the board's, the letter relating to the appeal of the board's decision. Is it before as well? And if you don't know, that's all right.
I don't know. I do know that it was raised in the division.
Can you tell us when there was a request for a hearing with regard to capacity?
I don't know.
Do you recall that there was one during the proceedings
before the board? During the proceedings before the board, no. It was a pretty, there was just a request that the change be allowed.
Now, I want to ask you a question about your ratings argument.
Can I ask one question before we change the subject on that last point that you made, counsel? Was the exchange at that point focusing on the physical condition of Mr. Misavage at that point by the family members who were communicating with the board?
As of June?
Before the board's final decision. They were focused on the dire physical condition and stress under which Mr. Misavage was under up to the point of his death. Was not.
I have the June 18, 2015 letter, and then there's the May 31st, 2016 letter from the doctor. But I believe the incapacity arguments were raised much later in the process.
In using those words, but these points were being made about his physical condition. And points were being made about his physical condition and his health in this letter and in the doctor's letter, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So I want to ask you a question about the ratings. The people who run our pension funds and rate them, I assume, take into account that people will act rationally in choosing their pension options, whether it's ordinarily early retirement. Assume in this particular case, a rational decision maker, given Mr. Misavage's condition, would have selected an ordinary disability pension. Wouldn't that already be factored into the rating analysis? Like, How would, I'm trying to understand this floodgates argument, when in this situation, looking at his condition, a rational actor would have chosen an ordinary disability pension. That's precisely how the rating system is set, based upon how rational actors would make decisions, correct?
So to characterize ordinary as rational, and possibly the flip side to that is saying early would have been irrational, I'm not sure that actually captures what's going on here. An ordinary disability retirement would have had different consequences for Mr. Savage and his family. If it had been granted earlier in the process, he would have gotten 43.6% of his salary as opposed to 100% of his salary. So to say that is what the actuaries would have thought he would do, I'm not sure that that's accurate. The actuaries are looking at the broad experience of how the pension funds have operated, and then those assumptions are revised, revisited.
Let's take a point when it became clear that his death would soon be ensuing. I'm not talking about November. We may be talking about, like, earlier into the year, February or March. A rational decision maker would have, at that point, converted. Yes? A rational decision maker. And my question to you is, the people who are rating the pension funds, aren't they making assumptions based upon rational decision makers?
Your Honor, we do have an application here in April, again, for an early retirement. So to say that a rational decision maker would have chosen an ordinary disability prior to then is disproven just by this record alone.
I wasn't talking about November. I was talking about later, let's say March of the year or February, when it was clear that death was was going to be soon ensuing.
Your Honor, I think you're inferring things from the record where there are no facts to support that. Again, there was an early retirement application made in April. So I don't want to call that irrational. This was a choice that the family made, and very sadly, Mr. Savage did not live long enough to get his early retirement.
I just have one last thing, just to clarify, boiled down to its essence. Your contention is, or the board's contention is, that the beneficiary's rights don't accrue until the application has been approved, correct?
Yes.
And so that in this case, Mrs. Savage doesn't have any rights with respect to the pension because the application was never approved.
Anything you'd like to add?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.